probably would appreciate that not changing. So, so that's what's up with the class. Anything else on your mind? Okay, so we are starting to get into a lot of really fun stuff in my mind. And I want to review a little bit what we did last week, but not in detail. So if you haven't listened in detail, especially to the second lecture from last week, you're definitely going to want to do that and come back and revisit what we're doing today. So just a reminder, you know, quantum mechanics comes about. In part, you have this wonderfully beautiful wave theory for light, and then experimentally, historically, you were driven into realizing that light, in some instances, has to be considered as particulate matter. So, equalization, so Compton scattering, the black body, between black body radiation, Compton scattering, and photoelectric effect, all three of them are part of the particulate nature of light. So, people were largely driven to that. Another thing that couldn't be understood classically, really, was the whole nuclear atom and the extreme spectrum of light coming out of atoms. And so the Bohr model incorporated and was able to give a mental model as to how the discrete spectra arose based on the nuclear model, which was experimentally shown to happen out of Rutherford. And so Bohr created this model where the electron moves in circular orbits, the electron is held via Coulomb attraction to the center of the nucleus. It really works best for single electron, although you can play games. You know, you can imagine having an electron in an inner orbit and sort of adjust the central Coulomb force for that and have another atom involved. So there are ways to play games with this, but it works best with a single electron atom. The electron just exists in discrete stable orbits. And in the Bohr model, this is an ad hoc thing that's thrown into the thing. It doesn't come out naturally from the setup, okay? It is input into the model. And the reason it's there is because there's a simple fact that when you look at the spectra of light coming out of atomic sources, it's discrete. So how are you going to make it discrete? So one way to do it is to have light coming in and out in packets, and have these packets of energy correspond to differences in these energy levels. So this is what Bohr was after. But that's input. But when you do that, you end up with quantized circular orbits, quantized energies, and more importantly, it actually agrees pretty well with what we see in the data. But it's not perfect, and it really is. The quantization is put in ad hoc, and you have some confusion about what's happening, because the electron is being thought of clearly as a particle, right? Because you have it doing a classical circular orbit. But you either put in a quantization ad hoc, or you might use de Broglie's idea, which Bohr didn't have the luxury of, but about 10 years later, you could take the idea that the electron is a wave, and you could actually find the same quantized orbits by demanding that you have circular standing waves. So there's real confusion, though, about the whole particulate wave aspect of this thing. So what needed to be developed in quantum mechanics, which we call quantum mechanics, would be a grounds-up theory where you interpret a particle for a particle moving in a potential, or you can think of an electron moving in a Coulomb potential, for example, would be the thing you'd want to solve for the atoms, and we're going to look at that. But it's a much more general thing than that, because any particle that's a wave is going to, that moves in a potential, you're going to have to be able to solve a wave equation for. And so quantum mechanics is meant to be very general. And the idea is to create a wave equation that is consistent with the ideas in quantum mechanics, E equals H nu, and De Broglie's hypothesis as well. And you have a potential in place, so you have to be able to have a force on the particle. So this is something we haven't run into with our classic wave equations. And I motivated the form of these in class last, the second lecture from last week. So I'm not going to redo that, but when you input those things and try to come up with something that would solve a basic wave equation, particularly one that would work for a basic traveling wave, you end up with this form, for which means our one-dimensional non-relativistic time deep in the Schrodinger equation. And we could assume that the wave function, this psi, is actually separable in space and time, and then separate this equation and get a time-independent piece. And when we do that, we basically end up with the spatial piece of the wave function and the time evolution that looks like this. So we talked a lot about that in lecture last time. And so especially if you've been concentrating on the exam, you haven't really paid attention to that lecture, you would probably want to go back and listen to that carefully when you get through the exam and then come back and look at this lecture. So these are the Schrodinger's equations. So these are wave equations that we need for particles with mass that have wave-like properties that are consistent with the quantum mechanics E equals h nu and De Broglie's equation. Okay, so that's what you end up with. And so then the question is, there's some interesting questions that come up. One, though, which is not so much here, but the fact that you say the particle is a wave, and we've already run into it with waves. Remember, with a wave, I can describe it in terms of position. Okay, I can have a wave pulse that I can describe in terms of position. And we found with Fourier series that I can take any periodic wave and describe it as an infinite sum of harmonic waves where each harmonic has a different integral multiple frequency of the original wave. Right, so this is the Fourier analysis. And you can go to aperiodic waves, which is not something we're doing problems on in this class, and certainly not on the test Thursday. But if you go to aperiodic waves, so now we no longer necessarily are demanding a periodicity, you can also describe those in the Fourier series. And the more granular the structure, but it becomes continuous, and the more granular the structure, the higher the frequency components that come in. So what that really means is if I take a wave and I localize it, the more sharply I localize it, the higher the frequency components are that come in. Okay? And the less I localize it, then the more sharp is it described in terms of its frequency components. So there's this inverse relationship between space and spatial frequency and between time and temporal frequency that comes out of this whole Fourier analysis sort of thing. And you're completely free to describe waves either way, but you have this basic strangeness of terms. If you localize one, the other one becomes less local. So if you take this basic idea and you say, well, particles are a wave, and you take the quantum thoughts about what waves are, so the De Broglie relationship, and E equals h nu, and you rewrite the space-temporal frequency relationship, and the space-spatial frequency relationship, and the time-temporal frequency relationship, using the quantum formulas, you can actually rewrite that if you've done this way. And what you end up with, what comes out when you take De Broglie's equation and E equals h nu, and this inverse relationship between frequency and space or time, these follow directly from that. And so what it says is the extent to which I have it localized in space and the extent to which it's localized in momentum multiplied by each other is less than some small number. H bar is Planck's constant by the time. So I can't know both of these with infinite precision simultaneously. Why? Because it's a wave. You're at the beach. Where's the wave? You can point at the wave, you know, it's over there, but where is there exactly? I mean, when you start talking about waves, it's a little bit, it's not a particle, right? It's a different sort of beast. And so this really raises havoc with the deterministic universe, because where Newton is concerned, you can know everything about a system. There is no limit in principle. Big enough computer, tell me where all the particles are, how they're moving, and what the forces are on them, I can predict the future. No problem. And this just throws all that out the window. I simply cannot know both where a particle is and its momentum simultaneously with infinite precision. And this has tremendous applications that are just going to come up again and again and again and again throughout your career, but certainly even within this course, we're going to be talking about a lot of aspects of this. So I looked at one example last time. I think I did. As an example of this, when we're talking about it, which is if you look at an atom, we see in the Bohr model, we just use a simple Bohr model intuition about an atom. If the electron is in a high energy state, very often they're not stable, so they'll drop back down to a low energy state and emit light. And that is the spectral light. At equals h nu, that light is emitted at a certain frequency, and that's the color you see when you're looking at the atom. In many instances, when the electron is in that high energy state, it's metastable. So it actually has a characteristic lifetime. And what you mean when you say it has a characteristic lifetime, it means if I, you know, look at a million of these things, I'll see something like an exponential decay curve with respect to time. So I can tell you, if I had a million of them, what fraction of them would decay by a certain amount of time. But for each one of them, there's basically wiggle room. I don't know when it's going to decay exactly. So there's some uncertainty in the time at which this state exists. Okay? So if it's metastable, and I have, basically it has a characteristic time, like 10 to minus 8 seconds or whatever, that's what goes in here. And if this is uncertain by a little bit of time, or even constrained, but there's some degree of uncertainty, it means you have uncertainty here as well. Right? So if this is 10 to the minus 8, you can calculate what the uncertainty is of the energy for the system. So even though it's in this particular energy state, its energy is actually uncertain a little bit. And the shorter the time for that metastable state, the more uncertain is your energy. So what this means is if you do the spectroscopy and you look at the frequency of the light coming out of that atom, it actually has a width in frequency. It's called the natural line width. And you can't do better than that because it's driven by the uncertainty principle. So you can build the world's greatest spectrometer, and you're not going to do better than the natural line width. So you get a lot of very strange things happening out of here. We'll have a little time later in the semester. This also underlies the principle of what's called quantum field theory, which really is the essence of how forces work in nature. So at the end of this, toward the end of the course, I'm going to talk about that, and that's really driven by the uncertainty principle. So these turn out to be really important, and they really come from not something fancy, but from simply the fact that you're calling a particle away. So they're very fundamental to the essence of what we're doing. At any rate, so once you say the particle is away, and you want to solve a particular system, look at the dynamics, then these are the equations you end up with. So you want to go back and make yourself happy with that if you didn't get a chance to go through that lecture last week. So the other thing that comes out of this is when you write these equations is up until now, every wave we've dealt with is a mechanical wave except for light. Every wave we've dealt with is a mechanical wave, right? It's the string that's waving. What is psi for the wave on the string? It's the displacement of the transverse piece of the string. It's a function you can picture. For light, it's a little different, but we develop this intuitive picture for electric and magnetic fields, And what makes it particularly different is that we find we have these two different quantities, the electromagnetic fields, that are coupled together with Maxwell's equations. So you have these self-coupled differential equations, which makes each of them a wave. You say, well, how does the E just wave? Well, it waves because the B is waving, and it induces the E waving, and the induced E is making the B wave, and it makes this whole thing actually work even without a medium. So that's what's so magical about life, and it's really wonderful. Here, it's a little bit strange, because here, the wave function is complex, this function psi. The thing that solves these equations is complex. So we can't really interpret psi in terms of just a straight, what is psi? So the standard interpretation came from Max Born back in the 1920s when this stuff was being invented. And Born's postulate is that if we take psi and multiply by the complex column, conjugate, so psi, this is always a real quantity. This then is the probability density for the particle. So that's really the intuition you have about psi. It has been somewhat controversial since it started. And in fact, the colloquium in physics this Wednesday is entirely on this basic interpretation of quantum mechanics. That said, it certainly works. But what really is psi is something people really do argue about now. If you interpret it this way, and I mean, it does work, so you do, psi may be more than this, but certainly psi satisfies this. Then, if you have a system, this gives you a probability density. So that means if I integrate the probability density over all space, I'll have a probability of 1. Right? The particle is there or it's not. So this we call the normalization condition. So whenever you're doing a quantum mechanics problem, you should always remember that this can be true, because basically we use this to help us figure out the details of the solution of psi and all quantum mechanics problems. Okay, so one of the things that comes out of this is we're going to see more is if I solve for psi, what I'm solving for is a probability. And this is a pillar of quantum mechanics. It also makes it a very bizarre thing to work out. In Newtonian physics, if I have something and I put the potential and I solve for the equation of motion, I solve for what happens. I solve for where that particle goes. You give me this situation, I tell you exactly what happens. It's deterministic. In quantum mechanics, you're solving for the wave function. And this wave function only gives you a handle on the probability. So that means that I can solve very well for a probability density for whatever happens. If I have a quantum mechanical process, I can tell you with what probability the following n things will happen. I can even give you a continuous distribution in probability. But if I have that system sitting here, I can't tell you what it's going to do. I can only tell you if I have 1,000 of them, how many of them will do this, that, or that. Okay? And that's a strange new world. And it's a big limitation. Yeah?
I just have a question about psi. So, and when we're considering waves, psi, so we're considering waves that are waves, right? Psi will actually give you a particular point, but then we consider waves of actual matter. Psi is just the probability thing.
Yeah, so all we can do is calculate probability to find a particle in a certain region.
So I have another question. So let's say we have a light wave, right? And we look at the interference pattern by using
right?
So we kind of see the same thing as if we found the interference pattern of the electron.
Yeah.
Will we use the same equation?
Yeah. Okay, so you're starting to ask about the interference pattern for electrons, and we're actually going to spend probably a week from Wednesday's lecture will be a lot on this quantum weirdness, but the essence of it is yes, an electron is a wave, okay? So if I send this electron through a slit, then the wave function has to describe the probability of where that electron goes. If it's a wave, we know that if I send it through a slit, it has to diffract. If I put film over here or something, I know that I should see a classic diffraction pattern if I have an electron beam. Okay? But quantum mechanics also holds true for single particles. So if that particle goes through, if it's a wave, I should see also a diffraction pattern. But I can't, because when I detect the particle, I detect it as a particle. It interacts with the film in a particular place. Okay? So if I send a single particle through, I will actually get just a spot in the film. If I send a million of them through one at a time, then on the film I will get a classic diffraction intensity pattern. But for every individual particle, I can't know where I'll go. I can only calculate the probability.
Okay.
Okay, so it's really weird. Now, you know the probability distribution. Quantum mechanics gives you the exact probability distribution of these things, and it does it very well.
So we look at the points will be a different sense. You know what I mean? Like, there's okay, so there's a bunch of electrons in the middle, then you have a circular region that's not, there's no electrons. Is it no electrons, or is there something?
If where the dark fringe is, if it's, yeah, you'll have no electrons. You'll have no electrons landing at that dark, that dark fringe.
So that's kind of like what I'm saying, in the sense of, we know there's no electrons at that point. So how is it a probability? You know what I mean? Like, I guess it's like...
Well, the probability is zero that we have electrons in that small region of space.
So you know it's zero.
You know it's zero there.
But
where it's non-zero, I can't tell you where an individual particle will go. I can only tell you what the probability distribution is.
Okay,
so now, just since I'm already on the topic, just to give you a preview of some weirdness, I'm getting a little distracted from where I was wanting to go today. But, so what does this mean? This means if I send a particle through a slit, then it has to have a side that covers all the space where I could have the diffraction pattern, which is very broad compared to the slit. And it could hit any point on the screen except where I have a dark fringe. Okay? And my psi, when you solve for it, you would find the psi covers this entire space. The very instant that the particle interacts with the film, wherever that happens to be, I know exactly where the particle is, which means the wave function becomes a spike of one probability right at that point. So this wave function has to collapse from some function that looks like this, discontinuously, to that. And it has to happen instantaneously. And I hope that bothers the crack out of you. Okay? There's one way around it. This is part of quantum weirdness. So that really bothers people. It makes people wonder about what psi is. It makes you feel that maybe quantum mechanics isn't quite right because you seem to be defying causality when you do that. Okay? There is a different... And so this now is a big field of study, and it's an ongoing field of study. But there is a very elegant solution of quantum mechanics, which basically says that the wave function is more than just this one possibility. The wave function is the evolution of this particle, and it does collapse in the reality of what you observe. But mathematically, when you describe the wave function, you allow all of the possibilities to happen. So it's all as if instead of talking about something continuous like this, it's imagining a particle that can decay quantum mechanically, which is spin going this way or spin going that way. So there are two possible states. Calculating in quantum mechanics, the probability that this is 50% and this is 50%. So the wave function has to encompass both of those because you have to have both possible to happen up until the instant it decays. The moment it decays, you have 100% probability that it's one way or the other, depending on what you saw. So you have that instant collapse, this instantaneous sort of collapse. But you can formulate the theory such that the wave function smoothly goes through this period of time, where in fact both of these happen. It's just you can't observe this one if you're in a place where you can observe that one, or vice versa. And so this is called Everett's Everett came up with the theory. It's the many worlds theory of quantum mechanics. And so it's a different way of looking at it, but when you hear about people who have multiple universes coming out of quantum mechanics, this is where it comes from. So one way to interpret this idea is that you have this instantaneous collapse in terms of what you perceive, but in fact the wave function itself just proceeds. It's just one arm does this and one arm sort of does that. And if you're in this universe, you can't see that. In this universe, you can't see that. But the wave function encompasses them both.
I just want to ask a question. So what does this integral mean for a traditional way? Another way of looking at it.
Be more a measure of intensity, right? Integrated intensity.
Okay.
Right, because amplitude squared basically is integrated intensity.
Okay.
So that's what I think you'd be getting for a wave pulse. Yeah. So I mean, it's not completely crazy in the sense that so intensity is in a sense a measure of where something is a way to think about it. Any rate, sorry, I've been getting distracted. Let's do some basic examples. So what I'd like to do is, as we already started last week, I want to talk about three particles. I want to then talk about a particle in an infinite square well, and then I want to talk about a particle encountering lower potentials. Okay, and so we'll get through quantum tunneling with that. And at that point, I'll come back and we'll start talking about more of these philosophical issues with quantum mechanics and looking at what happens with single slits and things like that, where quantum mechanics gets pretty weird. Maybe a little bit about entanglement or something. So, at any rate, last time. So what do you do with these wave equations? Right? It's really. It's simple. You have a physical situation which tells you what this potential is. So if it's a Coulomb potential, this is a 1 over R potential, right? And this is a three-dimensional equation. You put in whatever that is, and depending on the physical system, this is now a different function. So it's a different wave equation. And then you solve it. And you solve it for C, for psi, and you solve it for E. If you solve it for psi, you then basically have this probability distribution. And you can also solve for energy, which may or may not be quantized depending on what it is that you're doing. So that's how it is in principle. So what we want to do is to look at it more in practice. And so the simplest thing to do is to have the potential be zero. So that means you have no force. Right? Potential zero, then the derivative or the gradient of the potential with respect to the gradient is zero. So this term is zero. It's a free particle. And I motivated it last time, but this equation then can be solved by either e to the ikx or e to the minus ikx. And so for the general solution, we just add those together with arbitrary coefficients. So this is the general solution for psi for a free particle. And there is the constraint, which you get from a time-independent equation, that k squared, because when you crank this through the time-independent equation, you can basically solve for E, and so you end up with this constraint on k. So remember that k is 2 pi over lambda. So this is a relationship between wavelength and the energy, which is consistent with de Broglie's principle. So this, whenever you see a free particle, you should think that this is a possible wave waypoint. And, you know, that's a traveling way in space, right? I mean, that's, we have about the Omega Centaurus, because it's into the Psi-X. But if you were to add in the time-dependent part of it, when we did the separation for this equation, remember that this piece came out, so that adds the traveling piece to it, if you wish. So again, last time I made the point that this equation and this equation are equivalent in terms of form. So you can use Euler's theorem and rewrite the sine and the cosine and regroup and basically come up with this equation. These constants are different because you have to group things together, but basically you can either use this form or that form. You have the same constraint on K. And so then the question that you may run into is that if you do a problem, you have to figure out which psi is the right form to use. Because if you use the wrong form, you're going to find you'll run into calculational trouble. And so I think that one sort of comes with experience, and we'll look at each case as we go. But I think a general rule would be anytime you have an infinite sharp potential where it just cuts things off, it's easier to use the sine and the cosine typically. And whenever you have a step function or a tunneling thing, you'll typically want to use this. When you want to think of it as a traveling wave that hits a potential that may be trying to confine it, you want to use the e to the ikx form. But that'll come with experience. So one step up in complexity is the infinite square wave, square well, where you have the potential function goes to infinity at 0 and x. So what does that mean? The potential at infinity means if the particle is in this region and it's heading this way, right, the change in the potential with respect to x at this point, remember, which would be the force, right, force is minus dv over dx, is infinite. So the particle just bounces off the wall. But this is the way that you mathematically define the wall, is to have an infinite potential. So there's zero probability of the particle ever making it out here or here. In this region, I define the potential as flat and zero, which means inside there, it's a free particle. Okay? So because of the way that I have the boundary condition here and here, it turns out that this is the solution for the free particle in the middle, which is mathematically easier to deal with. So let's just start out with that. And then what you do is, here is our general function for psi, and now we invoke boundary conditions. So at zero, I know that the wave function has to be zero at zero because I know it's zero out here. So the derivative may be discontinuous, but I want the wave function itself to at least connect at that point. Similarly, it has to be zero at x equals L. So I then take this form and I plug those boundary conditions in. So at x equals zero, I know that psi is equal to zero. Well, the cosine term here is not zero at x equals zero. So I know that the cosine term has to be zero, so b has to be zero. So this boundary condition tells me b is zero. At x equal to L, I know that the wave function is zero, so this term is now gone. So sine of x is a sine kx. If x is equal to L, I know that the sine term has to be zero, which is what puts the periodicity on k. Remember, k is energy, right? Because for a free particle, k squared gives you that 2me over whatever. This is the quantization of energy that comes out. This is the quantization of the size of the bounds of the wave function of the energy. So that means that k is n pi over L, so that when I rewrite energy, when I use what k is and I solve for the energy, then and I substitute in for what k is, I get a quantization condition for the energy. This turns out to be a general rule. Whenever you have an attractive potential that's confined to particle, as in an atom, you will have quantized energy levels. So, okay. So last time, we then looked a little more carefully at that solution. I can use the normalization condition. Remember, we put the constraint on Kx at x equal L and at 0 for x. But that still left the constant A undetermined. And so the way to determine that is to use the normalization condition, which last time we did the integral. And when you solve for what A squared is, right? If I write this down, this is psi squared. And I say the probability of this particle over all space, if I integrate over psi squared, the particle is somewhere. In this case, all space consists of just 0 to L in this one dimension. And so I integrate from 0 to L in over dx in that one dimension, set equal to 1, and solve for A. When I do that, I get the square root of 2 over L. So this is actually the wave function for state n in the infinite square well. And so now I have an infinite number of these where n is equal to 1, 2, and 3, and I can picture them. Okay, this would be where n is equal to 1, I have pi x over L as the argument of the sign. For n equal to 2, I have 2 pi x over L. So I can now write these in terms of what the sign looks like and as a function of x for these different solutions. And so this would be for the n equal 1 state, this would be the n equal 2 state, this would be the n equal 3 state, etc. Yeah?
Go back to the seven.
Okay, so just a reminder, that comes from here. We just put a normalization in on K, you solve for E, substitute in this n pi over L or whatever K was, and that is what gives you the E. Okay, this is what psi is, but I don't know what to think about psi, because psi doesn't make physical sense. What makes physical sense is psi squared. If I were to ask, where is the particle, then I want to look at the probability density for finding the particle. So I look at psi squared. This is psi squared. And now it has some physical intuition. The particle is in n equal 1 state. I have a high probability of finding it right here at the center. But I could find it everywhere, but zero probability to it. If I'm in n equal 2, it would look like this. At n equal 3, the distribution would look like that. Okay, so that you should have physical intuition of. So if I ask you, what is the probability of finding a particle in the left-hand side of the box, you would take this function, for example, and integrate it from 0 to L over 2. Yeah?
Is that the probability to find it anywhere along the axis on the left half? Or is it just considering it on the left?
This is the probability of finding it. If this times dx is the probability of finding a particle in that differential x.
Okay, so
yeah, so if I put a dx right here, that's a high probability. If I put the dx right over here at the edge, it's a zero. And so if I want to know the probability, for example, to find it in the left-hand side of the box, I would integrate this times dx from 0 to L over 2. And that would tell me the total probability of finding each of those slices summed together.
So just to be clear, is it in anywhere in this slice, or is it just on that?
Well, this is a one-dimensional problem.
Okay,
so when I draw it this way, you sort of get tricked into thinking of two things. This is just one dimension. Yeah.
What does that mean?
N is what we call a quantum number. It represents the constraints you have on the solution, which come because of the nature of the physical system.
Right.
And it's a wave.
Were we actually doing experiments? We then looked at my end value
was. Okay, so the question is, if we were to do an actual experiment, how would we know what the end value is? We would know what the end value is if we did an experiment where we were able to either look at a large sample and determine the probability distribution for where the particles are. So that could tell us what the state is for those. Or we could look at the energy. So if we were somehow able to do an experiment where we could measure the energy of that state, we found that the energy of the state depends on
them. These being quantum energy states.
So these are quantum energy states. And they come out of the fact that when you solve Schrodinger's equation with that physical limit of the two walls, only certain ends are allowed. And that really comes from the fact that effectively, a way to think about it is you have a standing wave. It's really like standing waves on a string with two fixed ends. Right? That's why when we did that, I talked about how the fact that when you do standing waves, it's like quantized music. Because we have only certain waves will have constructive interference when they reflect. It's really the same thing that's happening here for the same reason. Yeah?
I guess I'm a little bit confused by that question. Do you have a specific n value for the, like, if you do, then you say n equals 2 in this, or are there, like, a lot of n's and a lot of states that are existing there?
There are an infinite number of possibilities. Any given particular particle in this physical system would exist in one of those. Okay? And in principle, could make transitions between them, but that would require an input of energy or whatever.
So if you were to, in this problem, say, I want to find the probability of a particle being on the left side of the box. You have a lot of functions up there.
Right. So I have to be very specific. I would have to say left hand of the box for n equal 1 state, okay. Left hand for n equal 2 state. I mean, and they're very different, right? If you look at the n equal 1 state, you have a very high and non-zero probability of finding the particle in the center. If you're in the n equal 2 state, that particle will never be right in the center. And be close, but it'll never be in the center. The probability of finding it near there is low. So the intro was a bit long, sorry. Sort of get to the new material now. So part of the issue is for any given particular particle, I only have the probabilities. So one of the things that you might want to do, for example, is to calculate what is the average that you'll see if I had an ensemble of particles, particularly if I had an ensemble in a particular state. So I might ask, what is the average position of the particle in the n equal 1 state or in the n equal 2 state? That's a separate question. Okay. And so in quantum mechanics, very often what you end up actually measuring is exactly that. A very good measurable that you get is what we would say is the average of whatever it is you're trying to measure for particles in that state. So in this case, I might ask for an average position, okay? And how do we calculate that? Well, it's really the way you would any sort of classic thing with a probability. This is a probability density for the particle. So I can use the probability density to calculate the average for something. So if you want to know what the average position is of a particle in state n for this particular problem, then the way to calculate an average, remember, is to take the probability and multiply it by the quantity, sum over all the states, and divide over the sum of the probabilities. So that's really what you mean by a weighted average. Okay, so you've seen that before many times. So in quantum mechanics, we say the average position, or sometimes you write it this way because it looks cooler. Okay, and instead of just calling it an average, which you can call it, that's okay, people would know what you mean. We also want to have a different name because we have to make it as opaque as possible. So we call it the expectation value. Of x. So this will be equal to the probability density, so the x weighted by the probability density. So the integral over all space divided by the total probability. And if you have the normalization condition defined the way that we did, then this is equal to 1 if it's normalized properly. So this is the probability weighted position. And you've already done this many times, right? Like, how do you find the center of mass of an object? You take the density weighted position along that axis. You can do that in the screen with the axis independently. So that's what we're doing here. It turns out that if you wanted to, you can take the expectation value of anything. I mean, if you want to determine momentum, if you want to determine whatever the characteristic is, you can calculate it using this formula. So the expectation value of some function x just calculate that way. So just to give you a sense of how strange quantum mechanics can be, let's look at the n equal 2 state and let us calculate the expectation value for the position for a particle in the n equal 2 state. So for n equal 2, psi of x is equal to the amplitude times sine of 2 pi x over L. So the expectation value of x then is equal to, the 2 over L comes out because you have an a squared. The integral of from minus infinity to infinity becomes just from 0 to L because that's the only place where psi is non-zero. And I have the sine square of 2 pi x over L times x dx. And I'm not going to integrate by parts right now. You can look it up, convince yourself. But when you do this integral, which is well defined, you get L over 2. We're talking this state. If I take 1,000 of these and I make measurements and I ask what is the average position that I measure, I'll get L over 2. And there's absolutely zero probability that for any given particle you'll find it with L over 2. Yeah? In this problem, I think because you're symmetric about L equal 2, the probability density is you'll get L over 2 for it. Yeah. The other thing for this, we did talk about last time, the energy, this is the lowest energy state. If I set n equal to 0, the solution is trivial. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So this is the lowest energy state. And if you set n equal 1 here, you get a non-zero value of the energy. Classically, I can have a particle sitting in a box and it can have zero energy. Here I can't. It's called zero quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics, because just, you know, we're beginning to see some sort of strange things happening. You guys okay? Any questions? All right. So I'd like to look at a different type of problem next. I'd like to do is to look at problems which sort of generically we would call step or barrier potential problems. The infinite square well, you can do approximately, but it's hard, you know, you're not going to have an infinite potential very easily in practice, but I guess you can do approximately that in the lab. But this is the kind of thing you'll see in lots of examples. Yeah.
So, you did the infinite square well example, but for a finite square well, could we integrate it
with the infinite? Okay, so the question is, we did infinite square well, what happens with the finite square well? You basically would do the same kind of thing, except for you would have to do the integral from minus infinity to infinity. We're going to do it, actually. Well, we're going to do the finite square well. We're not probably not going to get to it today, but we'll get to it Monday. And so what you find is in the free zone between the edges, you basically have the wave solution that we've seen, C into IKX or whatever. When you have a particle confined in a finite potential, it turns out that you'll end up with an exponential drop-off for size. So what you find is that the wave function can penetrate into the potential a little bit, but it drops off exponentially. So you do have to integrate out with a non-zero probability that goes to zero the larger x gets. So, yeah, so we're going to do this. And just as a preview, the fun part of that is what that means is, for example, I can have some free particle in a region, I can have a barrier potential. Classically, this particle can never go through that potential, but quantum mechanically, I have psi drops exponentially through here, so there's actually a non-zero probability that it can get through the wall. So this is what's known as quantum tunneling, and it's one of the really fabulous things about quantum mechanics. So, but we'll get to that because we're going to do that formally. So let me start at the start and let's look at step and barrier potential. So what's the difference between a step and a barrier? So a step potential would be, let's say that I set D equal to zero over here. And then at x equals 0, it steps up to a non-zero value. Which I'll just set as a constant V0. So here, the x is equal to 0. And it's a step potential, or you think of it as a step potential, if this is the energy of the particle. Okay, so what do I mean physically? This. This is like a repulsive potential if the particle is coming from the side, but it isn't sufficient to stop the particle and turn it around. So the particle keeps going, but it effectively loses some of its kinetic energy because it now has to sort of overcome that potential boundary. That's a way to think about it classically. So you're saying, is that like a step index of refraction? It may have some similarities. I'd have to think about that a little bit to see. But let me just proceed. I think it'll become clearer. So classically, right, this particle. We have a particle which has an energy which is p squared over 2m. Okay? And let's say that it's moving in the plus x direction. So it has some momentum and it's moving in the plus x direction. It'll encounter a potential or a repulsive force. I'm sorry, I'm trying to write too quickly. It's minus dv over dx. So what we have here is really an impulsive force, right? It's a really sharp thing. So so you have a sharp force that slows the thing down. So for x less than 0, then p is equal to the square root of 2me, classically. For x greater than 0, the momentum is equal to 2me minus p0. So a way to think about it is, as it's coming, because of the way the potential is structured, the particle is bebopping along here, it encounters an impulsive force, and it has to expend kinetic energy to overcome that particular force. But that force is not large enough to send it back the other way. It slows it down, so we have an acceleration. So that's what happens classically. So let's look at what happens in quantum mechanics. For x less than 0, we take the time-independent Schrodinger equation, and we say that v is equal to 0. So we have this. Which we've already solved for, because that's the same as what we solved for a free particle. And then for x greater than 0, it's very close to the same thing, but now you have E minus V0 here instead of E. So here we have a free particle. And here we also have a free particle. E is greater than V. 0, so E minus V0 is greater than 0. So it just is adjusted its energy. So in both cases, you have a free particle, but the energy is a little different. So that means if we look at x less than 0, and we want to know what is psi of x is a free particle solution. And in this case, for barrier potentials, typically it's better to use the complex exponential solution for psi for reasons that you'll see, because in a sense you're going to think of it as traveling waves. And K1 now is so that would be the solution for the wave to the left of zero. It's just a free traveling wave. And for x greater than zero, that's not speed of light, that's just another constant. Now K2 is different from K1. Remember, K is 2 pi over lambda, right? So the wavelength of this particle is different from that particle. Its energy is different. But the solution has sort of the same form. So now let's look at this a little bit, because the picture you want to begin to have in your mind for these kinds of things is imagine this. Remember, we have that time piece, either the IU or the H bar or T. So you can think of this piece as representing a traveling wave of a particle moving to the right in X. This represents the traveling wave of a free particle moving to the left in X. What's actually happening can be thought of as a linear combination of these two sort of orthogonal solutions to the thing. Similarly, we have that here, okay? And we have to have continuity in psi at x equals zero. So that's a boundary condition. In addition, unless we have an infinite potential, we have to have continuity for the derivative of psi. It has to be sort of well, mathematically well defined. So classically, if we have a particle moving in a situation like this, the particle is moving along and you have an impulsive force on it. That impulsive force is not enough to make it go backwards. The particle keeps going, but it keeps going with less kinetic energy. That's the particle world. The wave world is a little different. If you remember looking at waves when they encounter sort of a boundary between media. So we did mention the index of refraction, and that's pretty similar. Remember, we have a wave coming, and we have some of it transmitted and some of it reflected. This is a wave. And so we have, in fact, that kind of thing. So one of the new things that you get with quantum mechanics is that if I have a particle, even if its energy is greater than I have for this potential, I'll actually have a non-zero probability of being reflected, and I'll have some transmitted. Okay. So we want to look at that a bit. Say again? We're about to do it, but what it really says is imagine I have a particle moving from left to right. What I really mean is I start out with this, okay? And then it hits the potential, and when it does, it means that I have some non-zero component of that, which would be the reflected piece of that incoming wave. And then I have this as the outgoing wave, and part of the boundary condition for that particular problem is that this is zero. That is, I have no incoming wave from the other side. I could have it, I could find the problem differently, but what we're about to look at. But that's the way you think about it. Psi square gives you probability density. When I do psi squared, for example, if I'm looking at this piece, it's just a squared. So this square of this sort of gives you the probability of being in that incoming piece. The square of this gives you the probability of being reflected. The square of this would give you the probability of being transmitted. So when we talk about reflection and transmission coefficients, which will basically be combinations of the squares over one another. So that's where we're headed right now, actually, is to be able to solve for that. So, we have a particle incident coming from the left. Along the x-axis. So x less than 0, in this physical situation, I can have the particle coming in. Some of it can be transmitted, some of it can be reflected, right at the potential. So over here, for x less than 0, psi of x has to contain both the incoming and outgoing piece. K's are the same because the potential is the same for both. But for x greater than 0, in this problem, if we have the particle incident from minus x going this way, there's nothing to give you anything going from the positive x toward negative. So the left-hand traveling piece is 0 on that side. So D is equal to 0 for the general solution that we get, just from sort of construction of the problem. Then we want to put in the boundary conditions. So psi for x less than 0 at x equals 0 must equal psi at x equals 0 for x greater than 0. So all I'm saying is that the psi for the left-hand side has to equal the psi for the right-hand side at the boundary between them. So that's boundary condition number 1. So when I do that, at x equals 0, the exponentials are all 0, so I have a plus b is equal to c. And then the other boundary condition to put in is that the derivative of psi with respect to x at 0 must be continuous. Way back when, for our square well problem, that wasn't true. Psi was 0 on either side of the square well, and we have a discontinuity in the derivative. And all I can do is shrug and say, weird things happen when you have infinities. You can allow for discontinuities then. But if this isn't an infinite potential, then the boundary conditions are that psi and the derivative of psi have to be smooth and continuous. You can't have a discontinuity there. So, give me just 1 second. I know we're out of time. So this means that if I just take the derivative of the formulas up above, so I have A times K1 times I e to the I K1x plus B times I K1 e to the I K1x is equal to CI K2 e to the I K2x, and this is at x equals 0, so the exponentials all go to 0, the i's all cancel out, and I end up with K1 times A minus B. I multiply through by I, I guess. Yeah, that's what happened. I was just wondering what is equal to K2 times C. So that's the condition you get out of it. So now we've got a relationship between A's and B's and C's, and what we'll do at the start of class next time will be to we can look at those, interpret them in terms of probabilities, and then look at reflection transmission coefficients for going through the boundary. The next step will be to look at when the boundary is bigger in energy than the particle itself. So classically, the particle hits a boundary where the force is now large enough to cause it to actually go back, and it can't penetrate classically. But what we'll find quantum mechanically is you can penetrate, and the probability of doing so drops off exponentially, but it means for thin enough potential, you can actually penetrate through the other side. So in quantum mechanics, you can end up on the other side of the door. It's a non-zero probability. Maybe small. The door is thick. It's a very small, but it can happen. So it leads to lots of weirdness. Anyway, so... good.